Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we start with CNN's John King as Washington faces crises on our southern border in the Middle East and in Ukraine. We'll look at the president and Congress's response. We'll also discuss a guy from Dorchester who wouldn't invest in Massachusetts casinos, but plans to invest $1 million a day in GOP candidates for the U.S. Senate. Then, Matt Malone joins us. When he's not busy being state education secretary, Matt's rappelling down the side of 22-story Boston hotels. What was that about? And does Massachusetts' new best-in-the-nation education rating tell the whole story?
Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane on the explosion of Airbnb. Then we'll ask you, you want to spend the weekend in somebody else's suspect bedroom, or do you prefer no surprises at Holiday Inn? All this coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Marjorie Egan, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
So the crisis on our southern border continues, but while D.C. fiddles, Deval Patrick takes heat for saying yes, Nancy Pelosi takes heat for saying no, and Texas Governor Rick Perry sends troops to the border. Joining us for his take on this and other news coming out of Capitol Hill is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. John is also the host of Inside Politics on CNN. Hey there, John.
Hello there. Normally we get a little sleepy July when it comes to politics, but the world's on fire, a lot of political news. No rest for the weary this summer.
No, and now, just a little while ago, John, that we learned about this federal appeals court ruling, and as it's being reported, there's fears, well, depending on your perspective, I guess, it could upend so-called Obamacare. What did the court say, and what does it mean?
The court said that the tax incentive and the subsidy system that is in place for those who need help paying for their health care, that you can do that, that the letter of the law says you can do that through the state exchanges. But if your state does not have an Obamacare exchange and you have to go to the federal exchange, remember that was the whole healthcare.gov debacle. If you have to log on to the federal system to get your health care, the court said that that does not allow for the tax incentives and the subsidies. That's 34 states. So, you know, that's more than half the country doesn't get its health care through the state exchange. You have to use the federal exchange. So the Republicans are looking at this and say it rips a big piece out of the financing of Obamacare. They say it's proof that this is another example, they say, where the president overstepped in writing the regulations. The law says you can't do this, and this is what they tried to do to allow people to get those subsidies through the federal exchange. So, look, it's going to get appealed to the Supreme Court. The Obama administration is going to say they think it's bad law, but it's another blow to the president's health care plan, policy-wise. It's another big story about Obamacare in the middle of this election year. And now we're going to have to wait. It'll take a while to get to the Supreme Court. So the first thing the administration will ask for is a stay as they appeal it, and we'll watch the legal process.
Yeah, that's what I was unclear about, and I think you just cleared it up for me. So the people that are now depending on these subsidies to help them buy insurance in these 34 states, they're okay, at least pending further court action.
I mean, they're not good. Yeah, in most cases, the court, you know, the appeals court will give you a stay if they know you're appealing it and if they know this is uncharted territory. And this is one that's going to make it to the Supremes. And so that's the administration's position, is they will, you know, seek and they believe they will get a stay. But we'll have to watch this over the next few days and weeks.
But just to stay on the magnitude for one second, let me just read one line from the New York Times for those who just heard about this from John seconds ago or on the NPR News. Of the 8 million people who selected private health plans from October through mid-April, 5.5 million obtained coverage for the federal exchange, and most of them qualified for the subsidies. By the way, the average subsidy is huge money, $4,400.
Yeah.
So as you're saying, John, obviously this is not the final word, but it is a dramatic hit on this thing, should it survive.
If this ruling stands at the Supreme Court level, and the administration hasn't had a good run at the Supreme Court lately, if it stands, it rips the guts out of a huge part of the health care plan. Because, as you know, a lot of these people who are getting the subsidies, that was the point, right? To expand the access to get lower-income people who couldn't afford their own health care or whose employers didn't give it to them. The government would help you with a subsidy or a tax incentive, some way to lower your costs and to incentivize you to get the coverage. And that was the whole point, right? Expand access, get more people into the system. And if you rip this out, it's going to either kick these people out or tell them, the government's not going to subsidize this, and many of them, I suspect, would raise their hand and say, then I can't afford it.
Well, also the other option, of course, is the House of Representatives could just fix the problem, right? And that would, wouldn't that deal with it, John?
Yeah, that'll be done by lunch. Don't worry about it. Yeah.
Although,
lunch 2032.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I can't help thinking, even if you're not crazy about Obamacare, once people have something, I think it's very hard politically to take it away from them.
Yeah, but the beauty here is the Republicans did not take it away. And a court took it away, so the Republicans don't have to take blame from their constituents who don't like this.
I don't think that's necessarily true, because I think what will happen is people will say, fix it, fix it. The courts took it away. We have our insurance. You're taking it away. But anyway, let's move on to another mess in this wonderfully quiet July season, John King, you just referred to. This whole immigration situation, the president, of course, is getting hammered in the polls about the way he's handled this influx of teenagers and young children, many of them unaccompanied, coming over the border. Now we have Rick Perry, who has been visiting Iowa, the presidential beginning ground many times. Rick Perry, governor of Texas, is now sending National Guard troops to the border to keep people from coming over. What does Obama do now?
Well, I mean, the administration is trying to get Congress to act, and it doesn't look like Congress is going to act, or at least in any way near what the administration wants, before it decides it's time to go home for an August recess. So we'll watch this debate play out in Washington. In the meantime, the administration has said it doesn't think the National Guard is a good idea. It doesn't think that's going to solve the problem. It thinks it's much more complicated than that. And what you need is more of these judges, and I'll call them more administrators, people to give the hearings. The 2008 law guarantees most of these kids and their families a hearing. And so there's been a big debate, and a lot, like I think you mentioned, Nancy Pelosi. She originally said it wouldn't be a deal breaker to change that law. Now she's changed her mind. A lot of politics involved in that. But when it comes to Rick Perry, he has said, look, in the meantime, while the federal government dithers, and he's right, the federal government can't do anything right now, his choice is to deploy some of his National Guard to the border. It gives him an added national profile. Conservatives are cheering him, saying, here's a guy who's trying to lead and take action while Washington twiddles its thumbs. And it helps Governor Perry, especially with conservatives, and it might help him more broadly, people saying he's at least trying something. The issue is, if he deploys the National Guard and the numbers keep going up, does he help prove the White House point? So in the short term, this is good for Rick Perry's political profile. It's good for him, for someone who had a disastrous campaign in 2012, to have people say, hey, take a second or a third look at me. Will it look as good 6 weeks or 6 months from now? You can't answer that question, but obviously he'll be judged on it.
Well, he's taking action, as you say, John King, but at the same time you have this congressman, this Representative Castro, down in Texas, saying on the other side that we should not be sending troops, we should be sending the Red Cross, and this is a humanitarian crisis, and children fleeing violence don't need to be met by soldiers. They should be met with more humanely than that. So does Castro's objection carry much weight in Texas?
Well, we talked a little bit about this last week. Texas is a big, complicated state. So he's one congressman, and there's another Democratic congressman, Henry Cuellar, the conservative, who's been out from the beginning saying, they warned the administration more than a year ago this was coming, and the administration didn't do anything about it. So you have a split. You have a split across the state of Texas. You have a split within the Democratic Party. Most Republicans have a simple answer on this one, which is they say it's the president's fault. Send them home. And we talked a lot last week about where's the compassion. And since then, Governor Patrick has said he's willing to make a couple of facilities in Massachusetts available for detention. Not so they can stay forever, but, have a humanitarian place where they can get health care, get food, live a decent, have a decent shelter and a roof over their head until the process decides whether they go back to their native country or not. Even Governor Chris Christie has said that. Now, we'll see if he makes sites available. But when he was traveling last week, he said that. And he was in Iowa where the Republican governor said, no, not in my backyard. And a number of Democratic governors, including some prominent liberals, have said, no, not in my backyard. So we'll watch this one again. It's one of these things we're going to watch play out. If you accept the position that most of them should go home, the next question that I think people should be asking is, what do you do in the meantime, especially if they are children? And that's where we had the conversation last week about where's the compassion. I don't see an issue with Governor Patrick's position. I understand some people don't want this in their backyard. But if it's protected, if it's secured, if it's a federal institution, if the federal government is going to pay for it, I know that that some police, local police, might get some added costs and maybe they have to seek reimbursement. But if 90% of it's going to be paid for by the federal government and in 6 months it will be gone and you will have taken care of a whole bunch of sick children in the meantime, or at least children without a home or without a family or without a grown-up around them, that's the argument that a lot of people are making, is what's the problem with that? The problem is this: anything that involves the border and forgive me, but I think I'm right here, anything that involves Obama becomes so emotional and so political that people just have their, you know, it's going to your corner, yes or no, me or you, us or them, and they don't think through some of the more complicated, nuanced issues.
You know, we discussed this on the air with our listeners about 4 or 5 days ago, John, and a teacher from Brockton, right, Marjorie, called?
Yep.
And said, Jim, you are so naive to be supporting what the governor says and buying what he says about federal reimbursement. We always hear about federal reimbursement. It doesn't happen. They haven't approved the $3.7 billion budget request that the president has submitted. And that's my question, John. While the federal government has assured states they'll fund it, while Deval Patrick has assured the people of Massachusetts the feds will fund it, if it turns out this $3.7 billion thing that the president has proposed were not approved by Congress, would the federal government still subsidize the state's costs here?
At some point, the states would seek emergency reimbursement, as they do after, you know, sometimes you do it after disaster, sometimes you do it after some extraordinary circumstance where you're helping the federal government out. But to the caller's point, you know, there's every reason to be that caller, because if you've looked at Washington, whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, an independent, something in between, whether you've just given up, you know, you have every right to think, come on, you're telling me that Washington's going to actually do something responsible and send the state a check. That would require, you know, the Republican House and the Democratic Senate and the Democratic president to cut a deal. When was the last time they did that on anything big and important? So you can understand wholeheartedly that caller's skepticism.
Yeah.
I get it. I get it completely. Then you just sometimes just have to, you know, stand up and say, really? Won't they eventually have to do something? If some states with Republican governors take them in, won't the Republican House feel pressure to at least send that money? I think they will, but I get the caller skepticism, 1,000%.
We're talking with John King from CNN about the political issues of the day. We've gone from Obama's problems with immigration, now Obama's problems with Obamacare, now Obama's problems in Ukraine. Terrible stories about Russian separatists supposedly refusing to allow the bodies of the people killed in the airplane crash to be evacuated. They've finally done it, and all the upset about the access or non-access to the site, et cetera. Obama's taking a lot of grief, not only about not doing the right things, but seeming to be otherwise engaged during this whole mess in the Ukraine and the mess in Israel and Gaza and too many fundraisers and not enough eye on the ball. What do you make of those criticisms, John King?
It comes with the territory, and I think sometimes he does overdo it because he decides he's not going to let his critics dictate his schedule. I think other times, you know, I remember the Democrats were saying this all the time when Bush would go to Crawford and go down to the ranch. You remember Bush stopped golfing at one point during the wars. He said he didn't want to be out golfing when troops were in battles overseas. But he did take vacations. He went to Crawford, Texas, and, you know, relaxed on the ranch. And when the president takes a vacation in today's day and age, you know, all the technology travels with him. Air Force One is a helicopter right away. The National Security Advisor has all the codes and all the secure communications. The president can be anywhere in the world and do his or her job on most things. Yes, are there times when you need to be in the Situation Room when the, you know, world is literally on fire? Of course. But, you know, should the president have gone golfing the other day from Camp David? That's debatable, and you'll see that through your own partisan prism. Should he be raising money in an election year? You know, Republicans, I just was looking before you guys dialed me up, a bunch of press releases from Republicans saying, you know, world on fire, border crisis, president raises money. Well, I think if the Republicans would stand up and say, we'll stop raising money and spending money, they might have a better argument. But you know, they're trying to bait the president into not raising money, and that's like telling the Democrats, just, you know, drop your weapons. And again, Democrats did this to Bush. In 2006, if you went back, if some other crisis was happening in the country or the world at different points during the election year, and they said, oh, my God, he's just, you know, he's so partisan, he's so political, why doesn't he do his job? Comes with the territory.
Hey, John, staying, though, on Ukraine part of this, all of these economic sanctions, including ones that the president imposed the day before this airliner was shot down, the issue all along has been that while it's great the United States is willing to take action, the much more important action is from our reluctant European allies, reluctant because they get a lot of energy from Russia. What kind of job is the president and John Kerry, how are they doing in terms of enlisting serious support this round, in terms of putting the screws to Vladimir Putin?
I think you'd have to give him a, you know, B-plus or better for effort. They're making a lot of phone calls, and they're making the case that more needs to be done. I think you'd have to give them an incomplete, or, you know, if you're a critic and you want to grade them already, you'd have to, you know, probably fail them or give them a C or D in terms of delivering on those. And, you know, I think the next couple of days, as they start to actually get in and get the bodies out, let's just be human for a minute. Yes, we need the black box and the data recorders. Yes, we need, you know, the forensic people to get a look at what records they can find to be able to put together the pieces of exactly what happened. But first and foremost, I mean, this 300-plus human beings who deserve to be returned to their families. And that one is on Putin, to the degree that, you know, he has influence over these separatists. He can do more than he has done. And they've made some progress in the last day or two, and let's hope it continues. But to broader sanctions, you know, you're asking the key question. This is all politics or all economy is local. And the Europeans willing to give up their energy, or they willing to give up their other business dealings with Moscow? Early indications are no, not really. And so part of this is on the president continuing his diplomacy at a time when a lot of his relationships, look at the German spying brouhaha, a lot of his relationships with these leaders are damaged or frayed. They don't feel compelled to give to the United States right now. And in fact, their local politics probably stand up to the United States right now. So it's a hard one for him. And I think if, you know, it really depends on if Putin misplays, overplays his hand in the wrong direction during the investigation and during the recovery. That's probably what the president would need to get more from the Europeans.
You know, John, you, just as an aside, quickly for a second, I know you've been around for a number of presidents. Marjorie and I every morning have a conversation about the travails of Barack Obama. And I said, you know, is there a worse job in the world than being the president of the United States right now? We've discussed half of the issues that are confronting him now. Does the no drama Obama line, while some criticize him, some say he's steady as he goes. How is his do you have any insight into how he handles stress? I mean, the only thing I can think of at the White House Correspondents' Dinner at the exact same moment when our people are going to get Osama bin Laden. Seth Meyers is making jokes about it. Obama is smiling and laughing. What's the word amongst your colleagues and you about how well he handles these multitude of controversies and criticism?
I don't think you ever really know the answer to this question until after they leave office and they and the people around them start to write their books, because they don't tell the truth. If you look at him, you know, just if you're watching at home, I mean, just go to your laptop or your tablet and pull up a picture of Barack Obama in November 2008 and pull up a picture of him now. I mean, the job takes a piece of you. And I'm saying that, you know, if you look at Jimmy Carter, look at George W. Bush, you know, look at Bill Clinton, the job takes a piece of you no matter what. It just does. People say he takes walks. People say he gets to the gym every day. And people, you know, people around him say that he's got a good internal clock or system that allows him to, you know, walk away. He takes a lot more walks around the White House grounds now. We're told that just in the middle of the day, leave the Oval and take a walk around for a little bit to get some fresh air. You know, are they internalizing that stress? Does he have more of a temper? You don't see those moments. And this, mm-hmm. this president's staff, to their credit sometimes and to their detriment sometimes, are so loyal. Number one, they're not going to tell us most of those things. You do hear, you know, every now and then when he has like a friend from Chicago come in or somebody who hasn't seen him in a few months, you get a little bit more insight when you talk to somebody like that. But even they're careful, and to their credit, they're careful. They're, you know, having a private dinner with the President of the United States, their job is not to tell me, you know, that he pounded the table or that he, you know, used a few expletives. So you learn much more about that after the fact. Yeah. And I think we'll learn about these last few weeks that are pretty tense, you know, both at home and abroad. It's a tough job, whether you like him or not. I mean, you got to have some empathy for the inbox at the moment. But as to how they handle it, we never know enough. And the things you do here tend to be, you know, leaked by design.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, it is incredible how in real life you see people's hair go gradually gray over like 10 or 12, maybe 15 years. Presidents seem to go from zero to 100%. I mean, he had totally black hair when he came into office, and now he's like two-thirds gray.
Yeah, unlike, for example, the guy who was in our studio who's 80 years old a couple of months ago, Mike Dukakis, who came in second, who looks like a 50-year-old. So I guess that's sort of reverse proof of the same point.
You're better off if you lose. So we're talking about
that. The green line is medicinal.
Yes, it is. It is.
I guess that's it. We're talking to CNN's chief national correspondent, John King, who grew up in Dorchester. So we're going to ask you about another Dorchester guy. I understand you hung around with him as a youth there playing CYO basketball, whatever. Sheldon Adelson, tell people about his $1 million a day deal. This is a fascinating story.
Well, it's funny. I reported on Sunday on Inside Politics that he has had out to Vegas. He's not a buddy of mine. He is from Dorchester. I wish he would send me a grant. He owns the Venetian Hotel, you know, the canals and all, and he's doing just fine for himself. And he spent about $100 million in the 2012 presidential campaign, and he has been meeting with a lot of strategists inside and outside the Republican Party who are involved in the Senate races this year. And they left some recent meetings after giving him the polling and briefing him on the candidates, convinced that he says he will make a major investment. And one source in those meetings told me it would be up to $100 million. And there are 105 days now, 107 days as of Sunday, 107, so 105 days now to the election. So up to, in the ballpark of $1 million a day, that's a pretty good deal. Now, his top political guy yesterday, to a great reporter out in Vegas, John Ralston is a political reporter out in Vegas, his top political guy denied that. He said they're not going to spend that much, but he did confirm, as I reported on Sunday, that he had all these meetings, he had all these briefings, and if you look at John Ralston's reporting, just put his name into your search engine, the Ralston reports, what the guy said on the record was not that I was wrong, but that when somebody leaks the information of the meetings, we tend to punish them. So we'll see how this plays out. They're saying now that this leaked out, he's not going to spend the money. I think he wants, you know, Republicans to win more than his feelings are going to be hurt by somebody leaking a meeting. So will he spend $100 million or will he spend $60 or $70 million? Either way, to quote the great line from Blazing Saddles, and I'll use the word boat instead of the word in Blazing Saddles, he's going to spend a boatload of dimes.
Hey, John, the rumor on the street, speaking of Dorchester, is you're a big folk music fan. So in light of that, we want to play you a little ditty that we've been playing around the newsroom of late and get your take on it. Here's a piece of it.
Nobody got rich on their own, not nobody. Everybody needs bridges and streets to succeed.
That's too painful to continue with. Now, as you can tell from the title, that, of course, is the great classic, Run, Liz, Run, from those who are trying to urge Elizabeth Warren. We've talked about Warren a lot lately, but there's a story in the Globe today about how the reluctant warriors, for lack of a better expression, two Massachusetts people, Mitt Romney on the Republican side, Elizabeth Warren on the Democratic side, you know, people are saying, you got to go, the fields are inadequate, Hillary's not good enough, the Republicans are weak, all that sort of stuff. Do you ever laugh as a Massachusetts native? Since JFK, we've had a succession of losing presidential candidates what is perceived as an outlier state, Massachusetts. What's your reaction to all of this? They come from Massachusetts. Let's call them up.
There's something in the water, right? The country keeps rejecting us, and we keep charging the hill. God bless the tenacity of the Massachusetts. Romney has been very clear. He's not going to run. If there's a disaster, you know, if Jeb Bush says no, Chris Christie flames out, Rick Perry flames out, and the establishment looks up and sees Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, will they make another run at Mitt Romney? Maybe. I accept him at his word. I think he enjoys the attention. I think he's actually trying to carve out a role as an elder statesman in the party. We've talked about this before, whether you like him or not. The guy wants to be a public servant, and I applaud that. I'm not taking sides, but I applaud a guy who wants to be part of the debate, and he's willing to stick his hand in the blender every now and then. To Elizabeth Warren's point, it's a little tougher on her in the sense that, you know, we talk sometimes about Hillary Clinton's age. I don't think she's old, but she's not young. She's 66. Elizabeth Warren is 64. So if she wants to be president, this was Barack Obama's calculation in 2006 and 2007. If you want to be president and you're looking at a dynamic where you think the Democrats are going to win the next presidential election, and that's more debatable than it was in 2006 and 2007. But if you're Elizabeth Warren and you really want to be president and you think if you don't run, Hillary's going to run and win, then you've got to make the gut check. You've got to take her on. David has to challenge Goliath, like Obama did, because otherwise, if she wins and she wins two terms, you're not going to be president.
John, do you find yourself?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if she wants to be president. I don't know if she burns with it. I know she's liking this, and the people who have watched her on the stump. My colleague Peter Hamby's been at a few of her events, and he's watching. He says she's changing, and you see it, and she likes it.
Yeah.
And she thrives on it. And look, any party after a president, and we're late in the second term now, so this tends to start now. Remember how early it started when everybody turned on Bush? Democrats haven't all turned on Obama yet, but they're not worrying about him as much. They're not afraid to say something that runs counter to the president. And she's not, to say we need to be more active against the banks. The question is, does she catch the bug, or does she think she can affect the party's agenda without running for president?
So do you find yourself, tell the truth, walking down the street humming that song to yourself, John, or what? Pretty catchy tune, isn't it? Huh?
all the time. I like, you know, I like having as many Red Sox fans as I can find around the country running for president. Romney, whether it's Elizabeth Warren, I need somebody to either celebrate with or sulk with.
Yeah.
Yeah, speaking of that, did you jump off your couch last night as they had their biggest explosion of the year? Your Red Sox.
I was saying, well, save that touchdown for tomorrow. You know, choose one touchdown today and save one for tomorrow. But you know, I'm glad to see if Big Poppy starts hitting, they're gonna drive us nuts. Are they gonna get far enough up? Can they? They've been so deep. Can they climb out of it now? I'm pretty good at math. Thank you, Boston Latin School, and it's hard to get up there. But this is gonna be fun to watch if they. Don't give up. Keep hope alive.
I love how John King's voice changes every time.
From week to week.
No, I don't mean that. I said we can be talking about the world's crises, the domestic crises. There's one tone in John King, excellent reporter, and then all of a sudden we mention his Red Sox. And it's a whole different thing. John, it's a pleasure.
Send Brock Holes to Gaza.
Goodbye, John. John King from CNN. It's a pleasure as always. Talk to you next week.
John King is the chief national correspondent with CNN and host of Inside Politics. You can hear and watch that every morning in Massachusetts and I guess other places.
Everywhere, 7:30.
No, 8:30 in the morning.
Oh, on Sunday.
On Sunday.
But every single morning, 7:30, he's on the morning show there.
Get a long day, and 8:30 on Sundays. Okay. So we want to tell you guys, tomorrow we're going to be on for 3 hours. We're broadcasting from 11 to 2. Our first hour is only online at WGBHnews.org. It's BPR Premium, BPR Platinum, BPR Plutonium. You be the judge. To lead you over to the internet, we're having some great guests in that hour. Charlie Sennett on international news, bioethicist Art Kaplan talking about the future of caretaking, and that means robots.
That's an incredible
plus
story.
Sue O'Connell for Open Mic. Check it out tomorrow, 11 to noon, then online, noon to 2 on 89.7. No, 11 to noon is online, and the regular is noon to 2
exactly.
On the radio. Okay, up next, what lesson was the Secretary of Education schooling us on by rappelling down the Hyatt Regency? Secretary Matt Malone joins us next to answer that question and many of them from you and from us next on 89.7 WGBH.
If we're going to really be serious about having students read more difficult things, we have to slow down.
On Campus is WGBH's Higher Ed Desk. What's going on with America's higher education system?
David Coleman is the so-called architect of Common Core. In his presentations to teachers across the country, he has strongly defended the new standard.
Listen for reports from Kirk Carapeza on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Support for our programs comes from you. And Cityside Subaru on Route 60 in Belmont, where you can see the new 2015 Subaru Legacy with all-wheel drive and 36 miles per gallon. Available now at Cityside Subaru, online at citysidesubaru.com. And the Boston Conservatory, proud sponsor of the Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend, focused on training the performing arts superstars of tomorrow in dance, music, musical theater, and opera. bostonconservatory.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie again here with us in Studio 3 to talk about some good news for Massachusetts schools, charters taking a hit, the ongoing battle between First Lady Michelle Obama and Congress over healthy student lunches, and why he was rappelling down the side of the, I think, 22-story Hyatt Regency last week is the Secretary of Education, Matt Malone. By the way, he's going to take your calls, too, while he's here. Any questions you have about education, 877-301-8970. Secretary Malone, it's good to see you.
It's good to be back here. I miss you guys. It's been a couple months.
It has been. Well, I have to tell you, Jim Brown and I about had heart attacks an hour ago watching you and John Polanowicz, who's the Secretary of Health and Human Services, getting ready and then proceeding to go down the side of the Hyatt. Was it the Hyatt Regency?
It was the Hyatt Regency.
22 stories. My God, what was that all about, please, so Secretary?
So it was a fundraiser for the Special Olympics. And believe me, over 2 days, I think they had over 200 people take the challenge. They raised over $200,000 for the Special Olympics, which you guys know was just an excellent organization of supporting kids and inclusion. But what was best about the event is you get to the top, and the Boston Fire Department are the riggers. They're the rappel masters.
They were?
And they volunteered their time over 2 days. And you got to the top, and you felt safe. So I knew a couple of the guys up there from the neighborhood, and guys that I know. And I did not know that the fire department were the riggers. And once I felt much more comfortable and at ease, although it was pretty spooky at 22 stories.
Back
going
for,
off
yeah.
the side.
Did you look down? Did you look down before? I couldn't tell.
I looked down and I was like, wow, that's a long ways. And I looked over at Polanowicz and he's like, let's go. And at that moment, we just went with it. But it was definitely it was a lot of fun.
You know, I don't want to demean you, Mr. Secretary, but you are the Secretary of Education, and you said you're doing it to raise money for the Special Olympics. Have you ever heard of this, writing a check? Is that something you contemplated as an alternative, or you're not familiar with that behavior?
I did that too.
You did that too.
I had family and friends. So I have a niece who has Williams syndrome, mm-hmm. And
what's that?
Williams syndrome is a very rare genetic cognitive and physical disability.
Okay.
So it's similar to Down's.
Okay.
Kids are very musical though, and she's great. She's going into the seventh grade this coming year. But what this Special Olympics does is what I do with the youth boxing class that we teach. Every single kid can feel success, and they feel success through competing, and because they competed, whether they won or lost, they won.
Yeah.
And that's why that organization to me has a special place in my heart. And I just good people, and they had some of their Olympians there that day to take us to the top, and they were so excited, and it was just a great day. And the reason why John Polanowicz and I, it's one of those. There's a lot of things in state government that cut across health and human services and education. Mm-hmm. And John's a real partner in a lot of the work we're doing. So he threw it out there. He said, let's do this. It's a great cause. And he and I have been challenging each other all year in various different things. So it was pretty cool to get out there and do that with him. And I really enjoyed myself.
Is it too late for Marjorie and me to rappel
yeah,
down the
right.
side? Is
it
over?
So.
You guys
I don't
can
think
do
so.
This. Just,
yeah.
I think next year, you got to get involved, get early, get up there and do it.
I'll
yeah, when
myself.
I was in college, I was rappelling down the, like, just two stories for some it fire
goes,
regulation.
It goes by fast.
Yeah, but not if you don't know how to do it and suddenly you're hanging in the air going
you know, my favorite
swinging
line is,
back and forth.
By the way, we should put a link to the YouTube video on our website.
You can see it.
It'll be up and within a short period of time. My favorite part is you're on the roof of this thing, Secretary Malone, before you've even looked off the side of the building, and I hear him say to Polanowicz, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, this is great.
This is great.
By the way, literally, neither of us could even look at the video, much less participate in the thing, but good for you, and the Special Olympics is a wonderful thing. Speaking of success, and generally when a public official is in here, we're talking about things that have gone wrong. NE Casey Foundation, their Kids Count Project, actually came out with a rating of something that you were involved in. Tell us what the news was in the last 24 hours.
So this morning, the Annie E. Casey Foundation released a report where they highlight Massachusetts as the number one state in the nation for really keeping kids safe. And it's keeping kids safe across using a whole spectrum of measures, of metrics. And what was interesting about the report is it shows that we're doing very well and continue to do well, although we have more kids living in poverty, we have more issues of trauma, et cetera, and we're still achieving at high levels, which means we're doing a great job because we all know that the challenges that we have with kids living in poverty sometimes are almost crushing. And we're fighting back, and the state is taking on issues around early childhood, around health and human welfare, around education, and we have a winning strategy: education, innovation, and infrastructure. Working across silos, working interdisciplinary, and focusing on things like reading proficiency, healthy eating. We know that those are indicators that will guarantee doors opening for kids across a lifetime of learning.
By the way, our number is 877-301-8970. That was the voice of the State Secretary of Education, Matt Malone. He is here till roughly 1 o'clock. And if you have questions for him about anything about education, he'd be happy to take them. You know, you're talking about poor kids, and Deval Patrick is here once a month, talks about the gap a lot. I know it matters to him. But something that Marjorie and I fight about this all the time on the air, something that matters a lot to many poor families are the ability to get into an alternative education situation, charter schools. Yesterday, the Senate defeated overwhelmingly 2-1 a proposal, and it seems that well, tell us what happened and tell us what the administration position was on this thing, Matt Malone.
Well, there was a lot to like in this bill, and especially around the level three, the low level three turnaround strategies.
What's that mean?
Outlaid. So the bill had a component where instead of waiting for a school to fail in level four, it was to empower the local site level teachers and administrators to use practices of redesign to fix their own
problems.
You mean
the traditional public school you're talking about?
The traditional,
about. Okay,
to become more charter-like in some ways. To use innovation schools as an example as a strategy. But there was a lot of the House and the Senate couldn't come to an agreement. That was the first problem with this bill. And they tried to work out a deal. It didn't work. And as you said, it got voted down. I think if that bill came forward, I expected that the governor would sign that. That was a bill that I think was a lot of compromise over a long period of time. And I think there was good components on it, both on the level three side and the charter side. Never say never.
So when these things, because there is a lot of public support for charter schools, a lot of parents are trying to get their kids into charter schools in Boston and elsewhere. So what is the breakdown? There obviously were people that thought this would be a terrible idea. And I know Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz took some criticism because she was trying to shepherd something through. She was in a tough place, to be fair to her. But who's opposed
this is much
to this?
More charitable than you usually are, because most people think she caved into the teachers' unions that you love to criticize,
well,
Marjorie.
I know, but I feel bad for her. I think she was kind of stuck there. I guess I talked to her a couple of days ago, so I feel bad for her right at the moment. But anyway, was it all the teachers' unions or was it something else?
The MTA was a part of the crafting of the bill, and there's definitely this is a very complicated issue, really about financing.
Yep.
And that to
meaning me. Meaning how much the funding of the charter school is going to hurt the traditional public school from which the transferring student comes. That's the threshold issue, right?
So that is the historical thinking of it, yes. But if you break it down into its clearest form and think about a dollar following a kid in an open market, the money is essentially following the kid. So it's not money that the system loses, although it plays out that way. And the drawdown.
But the school from which the kid comes loses. I know that for a number of years they're made partially whole and then less whole and then whatever. But the argument goes, and this is the one Marjorie and I have had forever, and I'm sure you've heard this, Matt Malone, is if you have a class of 20 kids and two of them switch to a charter school, you're still spending exact same amount of money to educate those 18 kids, but you're only getting funding for 18 kids as opposed to the 20. And so a lot of the teachers' unions and others, some community people, say the funding formula doesn't fill the hole. Isn't that still part of the problem?
That is the argument, and this argument has been going on for 20 years. And I think that thoughtful, smart people can work out and come to a new way of thinking about how we fund this. I think one of the hang-ups with the bill was the tying the cap lift to the reimbursement at 100%, which likely impossible to do. Given
this is
the
state reimbursement to the individual
right?
citizens.
And I think
towns.
that was one of the issues. And I think both sides of this argument need to step back, take a deep breath, and reset and come back to the table to really talk about how best to get at closing gaps and increasing opportunities, thinking about a way that perhaps we can continue to grow charters and at the same time ensure that the local systems are able to support the operational.
So why don't
needs.
You do that? I mean, you're the Secretary of Education. I don't mean that as a joke. I mean,
that's right. What's the matter with you, Secretary?
I think you're pretty deeply respected from what the sense I get from everybody, even those who disagree with you. Pull the unions in, pull all the interest groups in, and lock the door and try to figure out if there's a way to cut a deal here.
It's It's a little more complicated than that. However, I want you to know that I've been a big proponent, and our governor is a big proponent of common sense. And we've been working with groups, advocacy groups and others over the year to talk about coming to a common ground. And, you know, again, everything in life I've found in state government, and you know I'm new to state government, is a compromise. And compromise is where you build consensus and you move forward. And no one gets everything that they want. And trying to broker that kind of deal on compromise seems to be the missing link here.
Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. If you have any calls or questions for Secretary Matt Malone, who's here with us in studio. You know, there has been a lot of talking about poverty issues in the schools and the struggle of many young kids who come from poor neighborhoods. A lot of blowback from Brockton, from Lynn, from New Bedford about kids coming from this wave of immigrants coming over from the southern borders, winding up because they may have a mother who's in one of these towns or a relative in one of these towns. So instead of being sent back to where they came from, they'll wind up coming into the schools. They're complaining, some of these mayors and school committee people, that they are already overwhelmed. Their budgets are right at the top. They're not serving the kids they have now. What are they going to do if they get a dozen more kids, two dozen more kids, you know, 50 more kids? Are those concerns legitimate, do you think?
Those concerns are definitely legitimate. Jim talked about, you know, trying to fix problems. I mean, here's what the real issue is. We haven't figured out yet, and the governor put it forward in his budget to look at Chapter 70 review. We haven't figured out what a weighted student formula looks like across the state. So we're truly weighting kids, second language learners, kids who come from trauma, kids who live at the poverty level, at the true cost of their education. So when you think about systems getting an equity of the from the Ed reform of 1993, helped local systems, but it didn't help enough in terms of the needs that places like I'm familiar with, like Brockton, have. So I'll give you an example. And after the earthquake in Haiti, Brockton had 250 refugees come to the Brockton public schools.
That's a lot.
They did not get one additional state dollar, not one additional federal dollar. We went all the way to Senator Kerry on this issue. Not $1. The fear is real. The situation, though, that we have right now, people have confused the two. What the governor has put forward is housing temporarily some very needy children in a secure facility on one of two military bases, not educating them in the local school systems, but going through the process of whatever that process may be of kids either going back to their native country or being repatriated with one of their relatives or family members.
Yeah, but if I may interrupt you, there was a Herald story just a couple of days ago saying that it's only four so far, but four kids who do have local families, from kids from Guatemala and Honduras, four of them are going to be enrolling in the New Bedford public schools. Now, obviously, four is not 250 or whatever, but there clearly is going to be some percentage of those people, if that up to 1,000 kids who've crossed our border end up coming to either wherever it is on the Cape or in western Massachusetts, some small percentage of that are going to stay here and are going to enroll in the schools. And that piece of the action is not going to be federally reimbursed. Is that that's a fair statement, is that not?
So that's the way it happens right now. I mean, when I got to Brockton, there was 15,200 kids in the school system. We were there this morning, and they have 17,400 kids enrolled for the start in September. We are a country that for hundreds of years has had immigrants come to our shores and go to our school. The promise of America is a free public education. If folks are
here, right here in
legally and they are enrolling in our schools and they are at the right age, not 40-year-olds trying to say they're 17.
Yeah.
I'm not having that. But if you're 16 years old and you have a right to be in our schools, it's our responsibility to educate them. Now, we can figure out the model. The model doesn't have to necessarily look like Needham High School.
Yep.
But the model has to be you are receiving a free public education. We have things now through distance learning, through partnerships with community-based programming where we can still educate second language learners who are coming with a whole host of issues that would many would say these kids could never be successful. We're doing a great job with them being innovative in our delivery of instruction.
That's the voice of Matt Malone, Secretary of Education. We want to talk to him about anything relating to education, the charter school vote in the Senate. What's going to happen to these kids if at some point they come to Massachusetts? In a minute, we're going to talk about the blowback in the Republican House of Representatives to the Healthy Lunch Program initiated by Michelle Obama. Let's take a couple of calls, though, for the Secretary. Bob from Worcester, you are next on Boston Public Radio with Secretary of Education Matt Malone. Hey there, Bob.
Hey. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Quickly, I see a quick turnabout in many superintendents, four or five superintendents in a school district in so many years. With that quick turnaround, I see dismissals of principals. I'd like to get the Secretary's thought on superintendents, the quick turnaround, and why there's such a turnaround, and why after 6 or 7 months they are getting rid of principals with undue cause. My children's schools, they love their principal. The brand-new superintendent dismissed them after 4 months, and I'd just like to know his feelings on that.
Yeah, you missed the beginning of the question because of a technical thing, but basically what Bob was saying was what he ended up with, too fast, in his estimation, turnover of superintendents and principals.
That's the new normal. I mean, growing up, you go to a high school, this principal had been there 30, 40 years. Those days are over. I think the age of accountability and expectations, these jobs are very hard. They're challenging. Superintendents and principals are in the glow of the media, on the front page of the newspaper every single day. The really good ones, the really successful ones that I've seen and been able to learn from usually stay in a place for about 10 years and get great results. And folks that are in and out of the door within a year, I think that's it's a problem. We're looking at issues around pipeline across not just principals and superintendents, but also teachers in the Commonwealth, and addressing what those pipeline needs are, preparing folks for the rigors of these truly 24-hour-a-day public jobs. You guys were talking with John King earlier about the president getting gray over 8 years. I mean, look at my
really?
Hair. I mean,
point to his own head.
I mean, that, I became a superintendent, and I went bang, and I lost my hair, and I'm bald now. So, I mean, you think about the realities. These are challenging jobs. It's, everyone's performing at high levels. I've been out in over 300 schools in the last 18 months. It's over 300 visits in single schools. And when you think about what I'm seeing out in the field, we got great leaders out there doing really good work, and we're getting great results.
Bob, thanks for the call. Staying on superintendents for a minute, I don't know how much this is in your bailiwick. Marjorie and I talked about, speaking of front page of the newspaper, the superintendent from Mansfield who resigned after these plagiarism allegations. And you can weigh in on whatever you want. The plagiarism thing, I think the consensus between me and Marjorie, had the superintendent, and these are my words, not anybody else's, tried to slime her way through the allegations. If she just admitted it up front, it was a first offense, my view, is suspend her for a while and let her come back. Putting that aside, the thing that put me over the edge, since we've been discussing money so much with you, Mr. Secretary, is she's leaving, I think, at the end of July, maybe it's all end of August, but taking a long plan for medical leave, which gets her to the middle of next year, for which the taxpayers are going to pay her 10 months. We called the school committee. The woman who answered the school committee in Mansfield, I think it was, said, yes, it's been approved by the school committee. Does that kind of thing put you over the edge? It surely puts us over the edge.
Well, school committees are the governing authority, and they make these decisions. Contracts, I think the public demands very straightforward contracts without much frill and perks. And I think one of the issues is that the caller right before you, this thing about getting fired in 5 months and being in the front page of the newspaper and being totally in the public, has created this sense of making sure we have all these protections in contracts. The only person, in the school system without a union on an individual service contract directly to the school committee is the superintendent. And those protections, in some cases, it's unfortunate that we see what happens, and it makes people angry. But I agree with you. I think, lessons learned. I've made plenty of mistakes in my life.
Yeah.
And I just sum up, and I made a mistake.
And, well,
I've said sorry more times, and I hate saying sorry, but I've had to say I'm sorry because I – screw up a lot. I mean, so, I mean, I just think that we got to be human. We got to admit that we're human at times. And I think we just got to move forward and just be upfront and honest in everything we do.
Well, the public's really, in my opinion, I think Marjorie Greene's wildly forgiving if you're straight with them after you've done wrong. Maureen, you're in Boston. You're on with the Secretary of Education, Matt Malone. Hey, Maureen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I'm a teacher of 30 years, and I also have two sons. Because we live in Boston, we've kind of run the gamut of education experiences. My sons have had Catholic school, public school, charter school. And at the end of the day, the Boston public schools serve them the best. And so I appreciate the secretary, some of his comments, especially it sounds like you have a good handle on the challenges of teaching.
So
we're losing you, Maureen. Thank you for the call. Thanks for your teaching, too. Yeah, go ahead.
Hopefully, Maureen, you can hear me. Look. The heart of the work is what happens in the classroom between a teacher and a student. And we need to honor and respect and support our teachers 110% every single day. And the teacher's got to deliver. It's a hard job, and you're measured, and we're focused on results. And you folks out in the classroom, I know the work that you're doing. I'm out there 3 days a week. I have two children myself who are in the Boston Public Schools, and I agree with you. I think the Boston Public Schools is doing outstanding work, and we have 351 communities in the Commonwealth, I think, who are all doing great work. But our Catholic schools are doing great work. Our charter schools are doing great work. I find greatness everywhere I go. I also find mediocrity, and we call it out when we see it. But I think what makes us special is an education state, and we are the leading state in the nation, and our governor can truly be called an education or the education governor, is that we have options. And parents have options, and people vote with their feet. And I think we have to stay competitive. I think we have to stay forward-thinking, and I think we have to work in professional communities to ensure that all of our children are educated to the highest possible standard.
You know, in the newsroom at WGBH, you're most famous for the following, Matt Malone. You know this. We've mentioned this other times. One of our colleagues, Abby, was actually a student of yours and remembers to this day having to chant, "Trash is our enemy, homework is our friend." Now, let me understand. This is not only the motto of your school when you were running it, but the kids had to chant this out loud. Is that the deal?
So I was the assistant principal at Duxbury Middle School, and yes, we chanted that all day long.
Love
and
that.
I walk down the street now, and people used to yell at me, "Trash is our enemy, homework is our friend." I went and visited Duxbury Middle School probably 2 months ago, and they're about to open a brand new building. It's going to be beautiful, but the when you think about special moments, when we got a hook. And we dug in deep with it, and that forever is our communication piece that will be ingrained with those kids forever. We had a lot of fun.
I didn't even go to Duxbury Middle School, and I'm never going to forget it, Matt Malone.
I get up every day and say.
Our number is 877-301-8970. One more quick question for me before we go to the phone calls. The Herald was reporting earlier this week. Actually, it was yesterday, so it wasn't that earlier this week. But anyway, that more and more children of immigrants who are learning English in Boston and actually around the state are winding up in special ed classes, and taxpayer watchdogs are saying this is an expense we can't afford. And is there some erroneous conclusion that because your English is a second language, you somehow wind up in special ed? It's a lot.
I was confused by that story when I read it. Quite frankly, it really wasn't a well-written story. So
I
was confused at some of what they were saying. Mm-hmm. But I took away from it that perhaps you see a correlation with some students who are not in sheltered English immersion classrooms being referred to special ed services in some systems. We do know that we have the statistics to show that overall, special education has too many African-American boys. I mean, those are statistical data points that we can point at and say that's not – we got to figure out what the correlation is there. But with this specific article, I didn't – it didn't provide the data that I would be able to look at.
Well, here's a piece of data that Boston officials say 21% of the 16,600 students learning English in city schools or 21% also attend special education classes. That seems – I'm a layperson, obviously, but that seems high, that one-fifth of kids –
The statewide average
of
special education, I believe, is around 16%.
Yes, that is absolutely correct.
So that's pretty good. I know that, isn't it?
I am the Secretary of Education.
I just wanted to be able to say that, Jim. Come on.
Well, I only knew that because that was in the next sentence.
So I want to say that it may be slightly higher, but I have to look at the state data overall to know if Boston's uptick is simply because of referrals. But I will say this, and Boston's got an outstanding special education department. If I have a special ed student, which I do, I'd want them no other place than the Boston Public Schools. I mean, they're doing great work, and I look forward to the superintendent and the special ed director continuing to serve those kids.
We only have a couple minutes left, but let's try to squeeze another call or two. Peter, you're in Worcester. You're on with Secretary of Education, Matt Malone. Hey, Peter.
Hi. Hello. Thank you all for taking my call.
Sure.
I really just wanted to take a second to say thank you, sir, and thank you to the Secretary of Education for the United States and to the President. To have you all recognize the work that Worcester Polytech did.
That was a great day.
To have the president come speak, not only for those kids, but the principal, the teachers, and the city of Worcester. What a day of pride, sir. And I just wanted to say thank you so much. Those kids and those teachers more than deserved it. But the recognition that you all gave them, none of us in the city of Worcester will ever forget, sir. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you for the call, Peter.
So we love the Worcester Public Schools, Superintendent Melinda Boone, and the whole team out there. But most specifically, Worcester Tech High School, Sheila Harry, the principal there, what an outstanding example of dogged, determined focus and focus around ensuring that all kids achieve at high levels. Hands-on, contextual practices. It's the model of everything that we want to see done well. You know, I'm looking at an article on Madison Park.
Yes,
and you know
troubled.
Before this article came out 2 months ago, Keela from the Globe wrote a piece about how we're using Worcester as our model, thinking about how Madison Park needs to reinvent itself.
This is the city, but we talked about this the other day, Marty. It's the only city's only vocational school. A report comes out that was quite critical. Was this a surprise? I mean, the way you read this thing, it was as if everybody was shocked by the conclusions. You're shaking your head no. We only have a minute or two here, by the way.
So Madison Park, rightly so, John McDonough has taken on
Superintendent.
Madison Park is where he's going to put a line in the sand. And he's put in an intervention team. This is their report. The report calls out what we've been seeing for several years. Our whole involvement with Madison Park is on the outside periphery of the shared space between Madison Park and RCC, this ROCS map, early college initiative.
Which the report criticized, even though that's your and Deval Patrick's proposal, is a joint effort.
So it's
they said that something like, the quote was pretty heavy in the report, saying we don't want to merge one failed effort with another failed effort.
Pairing a failing high school with a failing community college.
But go ahead.
We disagree with that because for the 18 students who were in the first cohort of ROCS map, that was not a failed effort. And those kids now have early college credit. They have college credit and they're in high school. And if you read the Globe yesterday, in some ways the Globe's been schizophrenic on this because they wrote that article. And then yesterday they wrote a great article about why dual enrollment is so important. And that's exactly what ROCS Map is. John McDonough is with us in ROCS Map. He's publicly said that. This report, perhaps unfairly, I don't know, I was not interviewed in the report, called that out. But I think that what's happening with ROCS Map is exciting. We have an amazing second-year rollout now, and we're looking forward to continued pathways. So we're moving forward, and BPS is a partner with us in that work.
So when this education thing ends for you, you can rappel down buildings. You can be a media critic, as you've been the last couple of minutes. Can I say one serious thing before you go, Matt Malone? We appreciate your being here, as always. I watched the whole Worcester Tech thing on television, NECN broadcast. It was a great sermon. The kids were great. Their speakers were great. You know what really, whether you love or hate what Barack Obama stands for, the fact that President of the United States, I told you this, Marjorie, stayed afterwards when most of the cameras were gone, and shook the hand of every one of the, was it 300 and whatever the number of graduates was so moving and so great. And the look on these kids' faces when they got to shake the president, it was just, it was a beautiful kind of moment.
It was a beautiful moment. I when you said that, I think back to the line in The Sopranos when Tony Soprano says, "It's not the man, it's the seat he's in."
Yeah.
And that is the president of the United States. And he gave every single graduate of Worcester Tech High School a hug, a handshake, a dap, whatever they wanted. And that moment will always be with those kids who earned that right. The only school in the nation to have the president come, only high school, and give the final address, a graduation, commencement address.
By the way, the lines are full for the secretary, and unfortunately most of you called in later in his time here. If you stay on hold, if you want to communicate, we will give the phone numbers for all of you to his office, and they will be in touch. Ms. Secretary, pleasure to see you. Good luck rappelling, and we'll see you soon.
I will look forward to coming back soon and spending time with you lovely people.
Thank you so much, Matt Malone.
For being here. Matt Malone is the Secretary of Education. Up next, couchsurfing used to be something folks did when they were in between apartments. Now it's a practice that has become part of an international billion-dollar business. How Airbnb is taking a page or two out of Don Draper's playbook to win you and government regulators over. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
WGBH sustainers keep this station going strong through convenient monthly installments that renew automatically. So right now, WGBH is giving credit where credit is due.
Thanks, Jaden Morrison.
Mary Pillsbury.
Richard Allen.
Hank Coleman.
Stephanie Borick, thank you.
Barbara LaBelle.
Hey, Robert Rice, thanks a lot.
To earn your own WGBH production credit, visit wgbh.org/sustainer.
Support for WGBH comes from you and the Commonwealth Shakespeare Company, the theater in residence at Babson College, presenting Twelfth Night, Shakespeare's classic comedy of Love in Disguise, playing free on the Boston Common July 23rd through August 10th, comshakes.org. And from Aesthetic, Reconstructive, and Implant Dentistry, Newton Wellesley, committed to providing a patient-centered, minimally invasive, and scientific approach to dental care and patients' overall health. More at aridnw.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. Airbnb, the online platform that lets strangers rent rooms or homes or in some cases a fold-out couch, is hailed as a godsend to travelers in search of cheap lodging. It's portrayed as the enemy of the hotel industry, and it's gotten unwanted attention from regulators. So in an effort to distinguish itself from the bad boy of the shared economy, namely Uber, they've launched a rebranding campaign that focuses less on the space you rent and more on the lifestyle that comes with it. They even have a new logo. It's an upside-down heart, and they call it BELO. I think it's BELO, short for belong. Here with us in Studio 3 for her take on Airbnb and their effort to rebrand themselves is Harvard historian Nancy Kane. Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hello there, Nancy.
Hey there, folks.
Hello, Nancy Kane. Good to see you, as always. So I didn't know that Uber, that I've taken advantage of several times, is part of the is a bad boy of the sharing economy. But just so people are clear on this, what would you say is the sharing economy? What does that mean?
So that's a, you know, that's a very trendy and increasingly popular term used to characterize businesses that make their way off, you know, base their business model, their services or goods on the internet, basically. So Uber, we wouldn't have Uber, and we wouldn't have Airbnb, and we wouldn't, you could argue, wouldn't really have, you know, all the excitement and verve and traction of Amazon without, right, the ability to literally call a taxi, call a limo service in the case of Uber with your phone, or connect with, you know, lots and lots of people that have rooms to let or houses to let, or guess what, Airbnb lets castles, tree houses, and yurts, I learned this weekend, that have yurts to let, connect them with all the people that want, you know, space in a yurt, space in a room in New York, space in a house in the Catskills. So it's the idea that that the internet, and particularly the smartphone, which brings the internet instantly to literally billions of people, right, opens up a whole new way of connecting people that have assets with people that or have things or services that others want. So
people to
brand
people
new
is
marketplace,
essentially the
whole notion. People to people, yeah. Brand new marketplace, all based. And I think sharing is a euphemism. I mean, I don't know what I don't know what modern day Don Draper thought of sharing economy, but it's not primarily about sharing. It's about, you know, fees, money, changing hands as it has for, you know, for centuries, for millennia, in exchange for goods and services. So it's really the interconnected market or the internet market or the smartphone global market that really describes the kind of, you know, new and increasingly valued, right, the internet, the market value right now, the valuation on Airbnb as of its most recent fundraising efforts. They raised in April $450 million from Texas Pacific Group, a big venture capital company or private equity company that invests in consumer businesses. Their valuation was $10 billion.
And their new motto should be regulators be damned. I mean, that's another, that really is another theme. We're talking to Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. I have to say my initial, but I think I'm the only one in the room who's actually done Airbnb.
You are the only one.
And it's great. I should say, I mean, you go online if you haven't done it before and you search a city, you put in criteria, how many bedrooms, you're going to have kids, you're not, whatever kind of thing, you have smoking, non, you know, sort of like you do in a hotel. Mm-hmm. And then you get to see photographs, you make direct contact with the individual who owns the apartment and that sort of thing. And it's a bit of a crapshoot, except their ratings, a la Yelp and
this
whatever.
This is really important.
Yeah, and so not only is the provider of the space rated after he or she obviously has rented a few times, but also the renter, which obviously is huge, right?
Right. So again, dear listeners, think about this. You, and this is really true. This is exactly true for Uber. So if we think about the sharing economy or the wired economy, however you want to characterize these goods and services. By the way, Yelp is a great example of a sharing economy service, right?
That's right.
You connect people that have used this service with people that want to know about what that service is like or that store, et cetera. So, you know, a very important aspect of literally people to people, as Jim said so acutely or so accurately, is who's going to tell you whether it's one, a decent room or yurt or treehouse or smoke-free apartment, and then if you're a landlord or if you're someone who rents an apartment and effectively wants to sublet it to an Airbnb customer, then how do you know that your guest isn't going to trash it? Ditto with Uber. How do you know, right, that the driver who picks you up, who P.S. are mostly limo drivers that are on their off time when they don't have when they're not giving rides or picking up people for their employer, right? How do you know that that car is clean? How do you know that car is on time? How do you know that the driver is trustworthy? Well, you immediately rate them. You're required to rate them. And so the customers and the landlords or the drivers and the users of Uber in effect become the sanctioning service or the sanctioning body that, say, a hotel would have been, right, or a limo company would have been in the more traditional economy. So the brilliant, the brilliant innovation of putting people together and ensuring to some degree, not completely, that buyers and sellers, you know, work together well at a level of decency in terms of operation and services provided and money rendered is provided by this rating system that's really important.
Yeah, we're talking to Nancy Kane about Airbnb in particular, but what is called, and I'm not crazy about the term either, the sharing economy. You know, one of the things I don't like, I mean, obviously they vetted this thing, and you say there's tons of new investment in Airbnb, but this whole notion that they're now focused on the experience rather than the thing, you know, this symbol, it's a symbol of belonging.
Come on, you're having a cup of tea with the landlord on the couch. They have this little warm and cozy thing. I think that is kind of baloney, actually.
Why are they doing that?
I'm not interested in kumbaya with the landlord.
Well, right, and it's interesting. The Boston Globe ran a pretty interesting story about this you know, a week or so ago, and they interviewed Boston landlords, women and men, couples and singles who are making money. In one case, a woman had made $23,000 last year, right? I think it was, I think she was a nurse, and she could take a shift or two off her you know, to-do list.
Yep.
At the hospital, because she now had this source of income. And she was just, you know, some of these people were describing, well, I like to buy chocolates and I like to buy little things for the room. You know, again, that is completely left to the discretion of the guest and the landlord. I'm sure there are guests that like to, you know, treat it like a bed and breakfast and have a good old chat with a landlord. And some of the landlords or the service providers want to do that. And you don't have to, but you don't have to do that at all. The point is, there's massive amounts of what we would call, you know, differentiation or degrees of freedom in terms of how the experience is offered and what kind of guests come in. So you can get everything, I think, from kumbaya to, you know, here's the lockbox with the key.
Yep.
and you know, and put the key back in the lockbox when you leave. And I'm sure that's true. But again, what I think someone like Brian Chesky, the CEO of Airbnb,
who's 11 years old, correct?
Right? Who's 32 years old.
Sorry,
he found, they found,
so
he and, jealous. He and a couple of gentlemen founded this company in, depending on who you read and how you, when you want to what constitutes founding in your book, 2007 or 2008 in San Francisco, when they couldn't find a place to stay for a big design convention and got this idea.
Is that what started? Is that how it started?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They
I knew
couldn't.
The year,
they,
but
there's
I didn't
got
know
to be a better way.
That's
they
great.
Stand there and talk about this because there's not a hotel room in San Francisco to be had. So. You know, one of the things they would tell you is that there's something for everything when you can connect this many people.
Well,
now, but I want to go back to the rebranding.
Oh, go ahead,
can
go
I?
Ahead.
Can
yes,
I? Because
absolutely.
The rebranding is really interesting, including all the reaction that their new upside down heart, which looks like a twisted paper clip. Or an IUD, depending on your
That's
perspective.
That's what some are saying.
Right? You know, it's interesting to think about what's going on here, because they launched this rebranding campaign. Very Dan Draper. We're in the business. It reminded me of that famous scene in Mad Men when he's talking. Don Draper, when he's talking about, forgive me, dear listeners, when he's talking about the Kodak carousel slide projector. It's one of the best television segments I've ever seen. And he comes up with this great idea that we are in the business of making memories. Well, gosh darn it, if Airbnb folks didn't go right back to that last week when they were talking about making memories, community,
point.
Lifestyle. So my sense is that very little has changed about the offerings and the business that Airbnb is in. A lot has changed about the advertising and the way they're describing it, including the logo. And I think this is a play as much directed at regulators. It's a, you know, it's a communication strategy as much directed at regulators and the general public's orientation, perspective on, opinion of, feeling for Airbnb, because the really interesting story on the regulatory front with businesses like Uber and Airbnb, which are in a sense too new to fit perfectly into established legal and regulatory categories, as P.S. Standard Oil was when it got going in 1890, and we had to create legislation kind of retrofitting that onto Standard Oil. The law always lags. One of the most interesting things here, the fundamental issue here, is how these new businesses are very strategically using the bully pulpit and the connection of the internet to get people to besiege regulators with, you know, protests against regulating Airbnb. They are literally doing that in strategic forums, in group forums. And the idea is somehow our services are so great, what we're doing is so new that we don't need to be and don't deserve to be and don't legally conform with established regulations. So that is really interesting, and that's new.
We're talking with Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. Explain this issue. There, the New York Attorney General has been after them because they're concerned about taxes and housing shortages and other things. So explain what's going on
there. Most noteworthy, this is happening in lots of locations, but the most noteworthy, most newsworthy place or most news-attracting place this is happening is in New York City. And the person handling it on the government side is the state attorney general, Eric Schneiderman. Sounds like a smart, reasonable guy by all the accounts I've read. He has, in a sense, his office has, in a sense, said, look to Airbnb, you have folks some of whom are single, you know, if you will, dwelling users or owners, right? Because your renter can sublet their space, assuming they don't have lease restrictions on that. A lot of apartment buildings have lease restrictions. Users, the folks leasing or offering the apartment on or house on Airbnb, right, you have lots of those people, but you also have lots of people, right, who are, in effect, becoming, you know, kind of sub landlords that have lots and lots of apartments that they are taking off the market that might be, you know, that might be used by people that need housing, including possibly affordable housing or rent-controlled housing, and leasing it on Airbnb because they can make a lot more money, right? The way the story works in terms of the money is that those folks that list their apartments or list their houses pay, I believe, between 6% and 12% of the nighttime fee to Airbnb in exchange for being on their marketplace. And the person who leases the apartment or rents the room, like Jim did, pays 3%. So Airbnb, think about what their costs are. They're very, very low. Collects this annuity stream between 6 and 12 from the person with the asset or the apartment, and then 3% from the owner. I mean, from the renter, from the vacationer, right? The argument of Schneiderman is, first of all, you know, we don't want lots of people taking all their landlords taking their apartments off to make more money for vacationers, right? That's not good public policy, and it's not fair to people who need housing. Secondly, how do we collect, how do we regulate standards on this, right? Because hotels have to have licenses, right? Bed and breakfasts have to have licenses. So how do we ensure that we don't have rooms going out in crack houses and all the kind of things you're trying to do with licensing requirements, that they're health, and that the health standards are upheld? And thirdly, right, what's happening to this income? How do we, in a sense, how does the government, which the government always wants a piece of income, how does the government claim its fair share of this income?
In New York, it doesn't as of the moment, right?
As of the moment. So, you know, you can understand, anyone can understand why the government wants to be involved in this new, really rapidly growing, highly lucrative for both Airbnb and people that let their space, right? Why the government wants to be involved here. There is no big surprise in that.
Well, there's another piece, by the way. I don't know if you just mentioned this a minute. And by the way, just to step back for a second, because we know a decent amount about this, just to give a sense. And again, this is from one of the founders in Thomas Friedman's fawning piece in the in the weekend New York Times. One of the owners of the founders of the company says 120,000 people stayed in Brazil and Airbnb rented rooms during the World Cup. 120,000. So it's all over the world. There's another piece. I don't know if you mentioned this, Nancy, because I was just looking for this little piece. The other thing a lot of attorneys general and others are worried about is if you live in an apartment building, do you want the people next door being a constant stream of people you don't know who are coming through?
Exactly.
They may be good. They may be bad. Now, on the tax front, Airbnb, it seems to me, is conceding because in a couple of cities, they've agreed to pay the hotel tax, which means they're ultimately going to pay it everywhere. But the laws are so, you know, we talked about New York and in California, there's this woman who rented a place of hers for, I think it was a month and a half or something. The law that she was not aware of says after a month, the Airbnb customer becomes a tenant. Right. She attempted to evict him when he wasn't paying the rent. And he says, I'm a tenant. You have to go through it. She had to hire a lawyer for thousands of dollars. She's got to go to court. The guy's not paying.
Nightmare. It's going
to but it seems to me, I mean, that's really the story to me. The story is, are all of these problems just startup problems, like with almost anything that happens that's new and different? Or is this going to be, as I said to Marty this morning, sort of like the Arab Spring, you know, huge promise and not much delivery? Like, if 10 years, if you're in our studio, are we going to remember this so-called sharing economy, Airbnb, Uber, as what spawned other giants like them? Or are we going to say, boy, that was a great time, but it didn't last?
No, I think we're going to say that, just like we say now, remember when, you know, Michael Douglas in Wall Street had this cell phone that was like a foot long and, you know, 6 inches wide. And he's walking along the beach, you know, looking for, I can't remember, it's Martin Sheen's son, right?
Yeah.
Charlie Sheen, right?
Charlie,
who plays
Charlie
the young,
Sheen.
Right, malleable Gordon Gekko wannabe character. So I think it's going to be like that. We're going to say quaintly, remember when Airbnb and Uber and, you know, Lyft, which is another Uber-like service starting in New York. P.S. Those cars have big furry pink mustaches on the front to identify them, just for your, you know, trivia pleasure. We're going to say, remember when they were like trying to, you know, wave the libertarian flag and blow the trumpet that they weren't somehow subject to government the hand of government regulation, we're going to laugh and chortle and say, wasn't that quaint? And they're going to be established players. Just like we thought Amazon was this quaint, money-losing bookseller. Right. And now it is still working through regulatory issues, tax issues. Where's its warehouse? Where aren't its warehouses? Right. And it's a big, big player. It's going to be bigger than Walmart real soon. So this is, there's nothing new under the sun here. This is a new category of businesses. It is soon going to be an established category of businesses, and we won't talk about the sharing economy versus the traditional economy. Brian Chesky and the folks at Uber, Travis Kalanick, are all going to be regulated.
Well, it's funny. When you say all going to be regulated, it seems to me that, just like the hotels are fighting back big time because they argue they're at a competitive disadvantage.
And the taxis are fighting Uber.
Exactly. It seems to me virtually, you mentioned Walmart, I assume not in jest, virtually every, what did Thomas Friedman write in that piece that this is, the 21st century economy versus the 20th century economy, big corporations in the 20th. It seems to me almost everything could be supplanted. Almost everything that we're used to, from hotels to supermarkets to whatever, can be replaced by Airbnb kinds of things, right?
Sure, absolutely. But the creative destruction of capitalism is never so, so clean and neat. I think we're going to increasingly live in an economy in which we consume goods and services through our phones and on the internet, but restaurants aren't going away.
Neither are hotels.
So what happens is Marriott.
A lot of people do not want to take a chance on going to somebody else's apartment. They want to know they're in the hotel and they can call the front desk.
Absolutely.
And
you think most business travelers who have to fight, the steerage at 30,000 feet in commercial airspace are going to say, hey, to their assistants, hook me up with an apartment?
No, they're
just not going to do it. Business travel is way too hard for that.
But you know what I think is another fascinating thing? You kind of touched on it, that when the New York Attorney General came down on Airbnb and said we need records from 15,000 people, subpoenas and all this kind of stuff and then there was the pushback online. And I think you see this now with this change.org where people were objecting and saying, that's crazy. And of course the judge threw out the 15,000 there. And
well, what
down.
The judge said is you don't have to give names for privacy reasons, but you got to turn over the data, and Airbnb did.
Yeah.
Right.
But I guess the thing is, people being able to go online to protest is kind of a neat new thing
totally,
as well.
Totally. And that's my point, that under the libertarian flag, we are different. We are micro-entrepreneurs, says Brian Chesky. And so therefore, somehow we're different and we don't need to be subject to the law or the tax code. You'll forgive my chortle, but that is, God bless, Don Draper. That's just way too far a stretch to have any kind of
It's fitting. When you say limited relationship to reality, I think it's a perfect relationship to reality. I think this country is so much more libertarian in many Democrats, Republicans, whatever, than they were ages ago. We don't want government. I mean, the ads, for example, where are they, on the subways? The way Airbnb is fighting back, New Yorkers should be able to rent out their own homes. I mean, that's a very libertarian, very appealing sort of message, meaning the Attorney General shouldn't be able to tell you what you do with your property, right?
So I hear you. So again, you can't blame, Chesky or Kalanick at Uber. You can't blame them for waving the same flag that has created their businesses and made them so big, which is this people to people, right? In this case, Airbnb to their customers or their landlords, right? Uber to the people that use it and to their limo drivers. You can't blame them for fighting back against government regulation. P.S. Business has been fighting government regulation since we were taxing wine moving on big sailing ships from Madeira. And, hundreds of years ago, so there's, again, nothing new under the sun. But here's the real issue, and you both make a great point about, come on, shouldn't we be free to do this? Look, there's a reason, and a good reason, from a lot of the regulation that Uber and Airbnb are fighting.
Oh, I totally agree with you. I wasn't disagreeing with you.
And it's the very presence of that regulation, right, including how clean Marriott hotel rooms are, right, or Fairfield Inns or any Courtyards by Marriott.
Love them.
Right? There's a reason that those things are in place, and there's a reason those hotels are so clean, and those are not unrelated. So government has always put in place a whole bunch of stuff for good reason. Is it efficiently done? Does it get tiring? Is it too much? Are we lacking anyone on the public stage to explain to us why these things are in place? Yes, yes, and yes. But that doesn't change the fundamental truth, which is we don't really want to live in a society without health codes. We don't really want to live in a society without the SEC. We don't really want to live in a society that has no renters' rights laws. We don't really want a society that has no small claims court. Society, right, would devolve in a Hobbesian way to all kinds of costs and behaviors that we would rather not deal with. And I say that euphemistically.
No, Nancy, well, I totally agree with you. I have to say my bottom line is I just want to belong. That's essentially.
There you go. That and God bless you. Brian Chesky loves you.
Here's my bottom line. When I go to a hotel, I don't want any surprises. No surprises. Nancy Cain, as always, great to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming in. Nancy Cain is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership.
Okay, up next, we're going to ask you about Airbnb. Is this the answer to affordable lodging, or is this the answer to circumventing the law? Is this room and board enterprise above board or not? That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
And before we go away, just want to remember, in September, mid-September, this show goes to 3 hours, 11 to 2. And for another trial run, tomorrow we're on 11 to 2, the 11 o'clock hour, only online at WGBHnews.org. 11 to 12, Charlie Sennett on international stuff. Art Kaplan talks about soaring costs of generic drugs. Sue O'Connell on open mic, 11 to 12, online only, streaming WGBHnews.org. 12 to 2, our usual place, 89.7 on the radio. Airbnb talk right after this.
I'm Bob C. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition, what is BPA and why is Senator Ed Markey moving to ban it? Science editor Heather Goldstone explains tomorrow, only on WGBH's Morning Edition.
Today at WGBHnews.org, could turning Boston into Venice save it from becoming Atlantis? If you missed this climate change story on the radio, check it out online at WGBHnews.org right now.
WGBH Radio exists thanks to you and Next Generation Children's Centers, proudly partnering with working families for over 20 years. You can visit NGCC's open house Tuesday, July 22nd at all locations, 4 through 7 p.m., ngccenters.com. And Citizens Bank, presenting sponsor of the Arts Walk down Newbury Street, open galleries with wine and hors d'oeuvres tomorrow night, part of the WGBH Boston Globe Summer Arts Weekend. More at bostonsummerarts.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie. Again, if you're just tuning in, we were talking to Harvard historian Nance Cain about Airbnb, is one of the new startups that's figuring out a way to meet a demand using, I guess you could call it, unconventional practices. In their case, that's in the form of everyday people providing affordable lodging by renting out a house, a studio, sometimes even just a sofa to sleep on. We want to know, are you among the Airbnb users who will never go back to a traditional hotel? Or are you a hotel snob like Marjorie, who thinks it's only hotels for me? We want to know, have you done it? Would you do it, both as a customer or as a provider of space in wherever you live? Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. I have to say, I've done it a number of times.
Yeah.
I love it. You haven't done it.
No,
and
I
you're
haven't.
Trashing it. It's
I'm
sort of unfair.
It. Well, I'm not trashing it. I'm just saying, I don't know. I guess I feel weird sleeping in somebody else's bed. I don't know who these people are, what they've been doing in there.
But you don't know how much silverware I've come home with. It's just some of the most beautiful glassware. And
I mean, I guess people are doing a lot of things in hotel room beds, too, and that's a good point. I was a chambermaid, though. I know how well we clean those beds between people's visits. It just seems odd to me. You know, obviously, money's the big thing. You can save some money doing this. You're going down to New York City, bringing your whole family. It's a lot cheaper and a lot more fun to stay in an apartment than have people in two hotel rooms.
When you say fun, it's a different experience.
It's different
really
experience.
Great. It's like being in, you have a kitchen if you want to do that kind of thing.
You can go to those guest suites. What's the place with all the kitchens that come with those kitchens?
Guest suites.
Guest suites, whatever it is.
877-301-8970. I'm really in love with Airbnb. I understand the downsides. We talked about all of them with Nancy. If you want to bring them up, it's fine. I think it is a great – I don't even understand the sharing economy thing. Whatever you want to call it, it's a great evolution of staying in places that – either you want to spend a month in or a day in or whatever it is. Let's take some calls. Let's go.
Jason in Narragansett, Rhode Island. What do you think about Airbnb, Jason?
Hey, Jason.
Hey, guys. So I've used Airbnb all around the world. I've met amazing people. I'm such a huge fan of it.
Here's a story that might, you know, illustrate what I'm talking about. A few weeks ago, I went to a buddy's wedding down in Long Island. Now, they had booked the hotel, you know, with a special discounted rate, quote unquote, for people to stay at.
Yeah.
That rate was $400 a night. Okay.
Oh.
I found an Airbnb, which was 6 miles away from where the wedding site was. Now, mind you, the hotel with the discount rate was 20 miles away. I paid $110. And I met a lovely woman who made me breakfast the next morning. We sat and talked about life and the world and the arts and politics and everything. I've done that all over the world, and I've met amazing people. I'm a huge, huge fan. And as a young creative person with no money, I completely love subverting the hotels. They're so overpriced. Like, what are you paying for?
Discussion now, over, Marjorie.
Just a minute. I can't believe that you got a buddy that invited people to their wedding at a $400 a night hotel. I mean, that's
I just came back from one.
You
same
did?
Deal, yeah, in Chicago.
That's
same
really
deal.
Terrible. That's really terrible. You go broke in your 20s going to all these weddings at $400 a night, not to mention the presents you have to buy and the outfits you have to wear. That was a great start, Jason. Thank you very much.
That was terrific. That essentially tells the whole story.
That's
I mean, it really does
story.
Tell the whole story.
Yeah, I could see you discussing life and love and politics.
Do you know how I love to meet new people.
The next morning. I don't think so.
No, but by the way, some people, as we learned here, that woman, I can't remember her name, was it Beth Tytel who wrote the stories in the Globe? Who wrote the story?
I think it was Beth Tytel.
You know, there was that woman from Somerville who rented her pull-out couch in her living room.
Right.
I'm not doing that anytime soon.
Yeah.
The whole notion of renting your whole place here and there has certain appeal. And for a lot of money, they can make a decent amount of money on the side. It is exploited by some people. By the way, that in the New York, I don't know what magazine we read it in. It was New York Times or was a magazine. I mean, there are issues where exploitive developers are buying apartments, obviously taking them off the market. That's a problem. There are issues of prostitution in some of these things you read in the New York papers. They're the outliers. Hotel rooms are used for those kinds of purposes too, Marjorie.
There are the clients who refuse to leave, and then you're stuck
That happened
somebody.
In California a few times.
You have
times,
to try to evict them in Palm Springs is the latest one. Okay, let's go to John in Princeton. What do you think, John?
Hey, John.
This is something my daughter and her girlfriend did, and my wife and I were very skeptical. She informed us she was renting a part of a house in Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. and it was right on the beach, and she showed us these great pictures, and my wife and I weren't familiar with that much with the whole, you know, air thing, and so we figured we had all these
thoughts, air thing.
We got kidnapped and, you know, et cetera, but when she got there, she made us a video, and it was everything it said. It was clean as a whistle. She opened the door and was on the beach. And the people that own it, it's a two-unit place. And some Puerto Ricans own this. And they keep one side for themselves and rent out the other. And it was really inexpensive. And they left a piece of paper in the apartment saying, don't go to this place. It's bad food.
That's
go
great.
To this place. It's that. She had a wonderful time that she said she would have spent 10 times that much if you just...
So, Eddie, now that you're a convert... not Eddie, my apologies.
John,
now that you're a convert, have you done it or only your kid?
We have not done it, and it was never on our list to do, but since she said that, my wife has been going online. We're planning to go to Italy in October, and she's actually looking... in Italy.
That's a great idea. Wait, did you hear me say to Nancy in the prior segment, 120,000 people who went to the World Cup in Brazil
yes.
stayed in Airbnb. It's huge. It is just, John, thank you for the call. And thanks for you. And for those who are nervous Nellies, I love that expression, like Marjorie, let's also repeat what we say with Nancy. You get a review if you're an occupier.
Yep.
So if you're a bad tenant, people are going to know and not going to rent to you. And if you're a provider of space, you get reviews too. And if someone's a problem, then you don't go rent their thing. I mean, end of discussion. Let's go to your hometown.
Eddie in Fall River. Thanks for calling, Eddie.
Hey, Eddie.
Hi, guys. And hey, you know what? You got to be from somewhere. I love you guys. The show is phenomenal.
Thank you.
I can't thank you enough.
Thank you.
I like the idea. The concept is phenomenal. Like the last caller or the two callers before, I had a terrible experience at a Microtel Wyndham place up in Maine. And if I had only known about this, because we were a little skeptical, we looked into it. I always go online to search with, customer reviews and that thing. I would definitely recommend everybody reviewing the concept before, of course, following through. But it sounds like a win-win to me, and I'm definitely going to pursue our vacation. I just canceled our vacation in New York City because of recent news on Thursday. I'll let you all figure out what happened Thursday. But I don't need to go there anymore. But I'm looking for a vacation spot right now, and I'm planning on using this.
So,
Eddie, let's be clear. You heard about this for the first time in this discussion?
Yes, sir.
Terrific.
I've never heard of it. I love it.
I love it. Eddie, after you do it, write us. Send us an email. Let us know how it went. We appreciate your
you.
Call.
Thank
Thanks
you very
so much.
Much
BPR
for the call
at WGBH.org.
And the kind words as well.
We only have time for one more.
Sarah from Somerville.
Hi,
what
Sarah.
Do you think about Airbnb, Sarah?
It's been great for us. We've traveled around the world with our children, and it's allowed us to enter into communities that we otherwise wouldn't be able to enter into, to feed them at home, to be able to move them about in very different cultures and maintain a home base in a much more personal way. And to get to know people around the world.
So you don't don't feel weird in somebody else's medicine cabinet or anything, Sarah?
You know, it's, I think, less than weird. What's amazing is how few degrees of separation you find. We have rented houses. We've rented an apartment multiple times in Paris now, only to discover that the person who had it was in New York working at a gallery and a friend of a friend.
That's great.
Wow.
It's intimate. I mean, you're in someone else's space, and it's very different. Sometimes you rent a place through Airbnb, and it's a place that's maintained. I've been in Nice in an apartment that clearly is just used for this. And so you don't feel like you're in someone's personal space. And other times, you're really in someone's house, and you discover things from their cooking books or, you know, all kinds of stuff is out and about, and you just kind of get to know how other people live in the world. I think it takes a certain kind of person. You know, you need to be prepared for variabilities you wouldn't find in a hotel. But you also have a lot of support. You generally meet people in the community, especially if you're in small towns or in rural areas.
Okay.
And it's just very helpful.
Sarah, that was very helpful. That was a great call. Thank you.
That was a great endorsement. Okay, Jim, maybe I'll stop being so boring and conventional and try it next time I go someplace. Okay, up.
They'll even put a mint on your pillow. Marjorie, it's not
well,
just
I prefer
the
chocolate, actually.
Okay,
chocolate
fine.
On my pillow. Up next, how many bottles of booze does it take to have a fully stocked bar? How about using the tried and true minimalist adage, less is more? How you can make hundreds of drinks from just 12 bottles of liquor? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
War on two fronts, Ukraine and Gaza.
The burden now is on Russia to insist that the separatists stop tampering with the evidence. We have serious concerns about the rising number of Palestinian civilian deaths and the loss of Israeli lives.
Two-pronged turmoil for the Obama administration next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Support for our programs comes from you and Northeastern University, where researchers are mapping people's travel patterns to forecast pandemics, giving global health policy a new direction. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow. And Rockport Music. Jazz at Rockport Music this summer will feature the Yellow Jackets on July 26th, Boston's own Grace Kelly on July 31st, and the Bad Plus with saxophonist Joshua Redman on August 7th. rockportmusic.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We were both smiling. If you went somewhere to get a cocktail and the bar was stocked with only 12 bottles of booze, would you worry you were in the hands of an amateur? What if they didn't have your favorite brand of gin or vermouth, or even worse, no olives stuffed with blue cheese? Heroes in Studio 3 to assure you that such a minimalist spread is actually the sign of a master bartender are Leslie and David Solmanson. They're the husband and wife team behind the new book, and it is really a fun book called 12 Bottle Bar. Leslie and David, it's a pleasure to have you. Nice to see you both.
Thank you for having us.
And by the way, the reason we're smiling, beyond the fact that we love the book, is they are armed and ready for action, ready to pour.
We are digging through the depths of our luggage.
Yeah, we've got liquor and strainers and all this
equipment. You understand, this is serious. We brought our grenadine from California homemade because that's how much we believe in homemade ingredients.
Oh, that's one of the things you want to ask.
Yes, it took up half of our little 311 bag.
Hey, before
we
even talk about
farm to table drinking kind of thing.
Before we talk about the concept behind your book, tell us what you're making for us. Leslie, you want to do that while David is preparing here?
Sure. This is called a Clipper Cocktail. We love old school drinks, and this one is a little gem that we stumbled on, and we are pretty sure that it has never been published.
Listen to these sounds.
I love them.
Except on the Pan American, North American run. Pan Am used to have the Clipper. You know,
sure,
planes,
yes.
Old school, you'd get your special, you know, dop kit, and it was really high class. And they also had a classic cocktail on every run. So the Clipper cocktail was specifically for the Pan Am North American run from North America to Asia. Oh. And, yeah, and it is white rum, dry vermouth, and homemade grenadine, in this case,
wow.
Straight from California.
So if you find a martini a little bit too severe of a drink,
yep.
Maybe it's not. It's a little bit big for you.
Not for me.
This goes back to the early sort of half and half ratio. So we're going to use an ounce and a half of white rum, an ounce and a half of dry vermouth. Most people wouldn't put that much vermouth in their martinis, but once you combine it with the grenadine, you're going to get this beautiful bouquet of flavors. So that's what I'm
excited.
Here.
Though we both think it's all about us, but it's really about you here. So while you're making this, Leslie, let me go to you again. 12-bottle bar, what's the concept behind the book and the whole thing?
Can I interject something really quick?
You can
quick?
Do whatever you want.
Because you brought up an interesting statement, so I'm sure we'll meander here, mm-hmm. right, for a while. But you said it's not all about you, it's all about us. But actually, what's interesting is right now it is all about you. Because even though you are the host of the show,
we are
the hosts of your drink. So, in that case, you've become our guests. We have a nice little meta situation going on here,
that.
Right? But you've become our guests. So
it's like the Matrix in here.
It is.
So.
That's right.
Red pill or blue pill. So, you know, that is an important part of what the book is about and that idea of entertaining and taking care of your guests. And so it was just sort of interesting that you brought that
so
up.
So we're your guests? Is that what you said?
Yeah, you're our guests.
Can I have an order of fried calamari, please, while you're
I'll take care of that. It's perfect. Fried food is great for sopping up all that alcohol, so remember
that. So what is the concept? David, let me go to you. Yeah. David, sure. What is the 12-bottle bar? What's the concept?
We love classic cocktails. We have a family. We don't have the ability to go out all the time. We don't have the ability to afford a $20 cocktail every time we go out. So the idea was, how do we do this at home? How do we make hundreds of cocktails, the stuff we like and the stuff that we want to have ready for our guests at home on a budget? What we came up with was the easiest way to contain that experience was to limit the ingredients. So rather than every time you open up a book in your or magazine and you find a recipe that calls for another, we call it creme d'esoterica.
It costs $70
a pop. $70,
yeah.
And it's made with the tears of nuns from a monastery in the hills of, you know, Italy.
I think that exists, actually.
Yes.
I have one.
The nun or the bottle?
So,
really, Jim?
No. Can I interrupt you to say, you make a wonderful point. Well, I'm sure you know you made a wonderful point, David. There is nothing more frustrating than opening up a recipe for anything, whether it is a cocktail or a meal, where you just don't have the ingredients. Mm-hmm. But the question, you said you can make hundreds and hundreds of drinks. Your contention in this fine little new book, it's coming out, I guess, formally in August, is that you can make almost anything with just 12 items, correct? Is that not the
correct.
Notion?
You can't make tequila drinks with our book. We left tequila out, but you could use the same principles to apply to any spirit.
So what are the 12 bottles? Tell people what the 12 bottles are.
I'm going to mix while you.
Yeah.
All right. So we basically have the 12-bottle bar. A lot of people are surprised because they think, well, why isn't it all spirits?
Yeah.
And our answer, of course, is, well, you can't make a drink just with spirits, and you've got to spend money on the other stuff. Again, we're trying to keep it contained. And just to let you know, on the bottom end, if you're buying the low-end bottles, because we do recommend, you know, low-end bottles, mid-range, and artisan bottlings. You know, nothing that was no paid placement here. These are personal choices
mm-hmm. okay.
to give the average person who may go into a liquor store and just be overwhelmed, you know, where to start. So on the low end, you're looking at about $200 all in for all the bottles. And at the high end, if you bought everyone premium, $350 roughly.
So in other words, if you want a really expensive kind of vodka as opposed to, you know, whatever.
Exactly.
So what are the 12, Leslie?
Yes, so the 12 are, we have 7 spirits. We have dry gin. We have light rum. We have dark rum. We have brandy. We have rye whiskey. And we have vodka and Genever. And I can talk
who?
Who? Yes, he's a very nice man down the street.
What is Genever?
Genever is a lot of people call it the original gin. It's the great-great-granddaddy of gin, and gin would never have existed without it.
Mm-hmm.
It came about in the lowlands of Holland and Belgium way, way back, even in the 1500s, when it was a medicinal tonic with junipers at the base, juniper berries. Uh-huh. And it evolved into something that a little company called Bowles, you might have heard of them if you ever go and look at the fruit liqueurs. And they created this malted beverage using a malted barley and wheat and rye base, and then added juniper and other botanicals. So you get something that's somewhat akin to whiskey, but also has elements of gin. It's a bridge, if you will.
What's missing from the 12? You didn't get the 12.
Right, I didn't. So that's the seven spirits. Then we have one liqueur, only one orange liqueur, because it is absolutely the most used liqueur in the most cocktails. And then a sweet and a dry vermouth, and orange bitters, and aromatic bitters.
Is the biggest criticism, David, you mentioned tequila is not on the list. Is that what you get the most blowback on? Why didn't tequila make the top dozen? Is that the one?
No, actually, it's why did we include vermouth and bitters among our bottles? That initially, people thought we were 12 spirits bar. And the reason we did include vermouth and spirits is because they were bottles that we didn't find in most average homes. We'd go to a friend's house, and they typically have a bottle of Gold Cuervo up in a top pantry somewhere, and they have the makings of a margarita or something, but they typically don't. You know, most people are afraid of things like bitters, and because of our vodka martini culture of vermouth as well.
Yeah, you know, it is true. I don't think I've ever used bitters, and I probably should be using
bitters. You cook, though, I assume.
Well, not really very well.
Prune chicken. Nobody makes prune chicken better than this woman.
But if you're making a dish, I like to use the analogy of a steak. If you're making a steak, you're going to put a little salt and pepper on it.
Yes, I am, and other things, too.
And you're not going to put the salt and pepper or the garlic salt or whatever you put on it to taste salty and peppery.
Right.
You're going to put it on to bring out the natural flavors of that. Same with any dish. Same with if you're doing vegetables. You put a little olive oil, a little salt, a little lemon juice. That's what bitters do. That's what vermouth does. They're meant to enhance the other flavors. They're not meant to take over the drink.
We're talking to Leslie and David Salmonson. Their new book is called The 12 Bottle Bar, which is huge fun. And before we sample your is it called The Clipper? Is that what
this
thing is?
The Clipper. Yeah.
The Clipper. My favorite part of the book, without a close second, even though they're a great set, is the whole discussion of ice. I have to say, it never occurred to me that ice was an issue. And your recommendation, which you admit is slightly unrealistic, is we should all bring ice blocks home.
That's right.
And chip it all. Okay.
Well, we're in Boston, we're in the right place
That's right.
So commercial ice started here. You guys
didn't know that, but we know it now. So what's the right and the wrong, the quick version of ice?
Well, something that you just need to remember first off is that, you know, a drink basically starts out when you're measuring it roughly 3 ounces. Once you shake or stir it, you will add about an ounce of dilution from water, from your ice. What happens if your ice smells like the frozen broccoli that's in your freezer?
Which never occurred to
me. You're going to have a broccoli martini.
It's a great point.
Right?
Broccoli martini.
Yeah. Which is great if you're using broccoli bitters, but those don't exist, and let's not even go there. So the point is, if your ice is not at least the best quality you can make it, then everything that you're doing to that drink will be undermined.
What's the best quality? How do you do, other than a block of ice, what's the best quality you can make it, David?
Well, we like, if you've got a good refrigerator and you've got a refrigerator that comes with a filter, that's typically fine.
Yeah.
We use a lot of ice mold. So how you apply the ice is equally as important as the quality of the ice.
Apply it to the drink.
To the drink. So if you want something like a mint julep, you want crushed ice or shaved ice. You want a quick chill and you want the dilution because it's not a drink that has much water that goes into it. If you have something like an old fashioned or a cocktail, you want a big block of ice to chill it but to dilute slowly. Punch bowl gets a big, you know, bundt pan ring. So how you apply the ice to a cocktail is as important as how you apply heat to cooking.
So when
sometimes you bake, sometimes you grill.
So when I scrape the frost off the side of my freezer and put it in my drink, that's not the right way to go. Is that what you're telling me?
I think I'm going to Marjorie's house tonight to drink.
Fine.
I'm not quite that bad. You know what my favorite part of the book was? Not the ice part, although I found that fascinating, was when you talked about the Algonquin Hotel where Dorothy Parker used to go and James Thurber used to go, and you can still go, Noel Coward, where they all hung around and had drinks and exchanged barbs and stuff. Because it reminded me of the drinking culture, which has changed dramatically. You know, I think if you went out and spent 3 or 4 hours every night and you were not 20 years old in a bar with your friends, people would think you were like, you know, you had a booze problem. But there was something really nice about that culture that is sort of gone now. It's brought back a little bit of Mad Men.
I have a great story I'd like to quickly tell you about that. But part of the thing is we'd like to bring back the cocktail party.
Me
like people.
Too.
Yeah, this is a cocktail party in a book.
Maybe we don't do it hotels.
Yep.
But maybe we bring people to our house, and you know, there are drinks out there beyond light beer that you can serve to guests. Yeah, and they're easy to
Why
make.
Why is he looking at me?
Just put the freezer ice in the light beer.
Yeah,
you know.
Light beer. And you have a beer slushy.
No, I'm totally psyched for this weekend. I'm going to break out and do some different things.
But the story, when you mentioned the Algonquin, the great story is we have a recipe in the book called the Benchley, and there's a classic cocktail called the Algonquin. I'm not a big fan of it. We decided, how are we going to improve this cocktail? So we made a drink called the Benchley, and we put a little sriracha in with the pineapple to give
there.
It a little heat.
Robert Benchley was there a lot.
So we did this drink, and we did it for a friend's event. And it lived on the site for a while. Well, 6 months later, I get an email out of the blue from Nat Benchley, Peter's younger brother and grandson of Robert Benchley, going, that was kind of nice.
Oh, that did. Great.
And the reason I tell the story is it's the camaraderie.
Yes.
Again, it's friendship and kinship through the drink, whether it's across the Algonquin table or the internet. We still find that in cocktails.
Okay, David, enough small talk. I mean, you made a clipper. Leslie gave us a preview of what it was looking like. You've been mixing and straining or whatever the appropriate verbs are. Are we ready to taste?
You can taste it. So this is your martini extra dry vermouth that we have here is going to have a little more sweeter botanicals than some others, and it's got a golden color to it. You can actually see it in the cup here. Mm-hmm. So it adds it takes the grenadine and makes it a little more brown. So if you used a perfectly clear vermouth, you get a pinker drink. But still, what you're going to look for here is a little bit of sweetness. You want
to
try that?
I'd love to. Thank you.
A little bit of sweetness. You're going to get the rum character. You're going to get, hopefully, a balance of the flavors.
Oh, my goodness.
Hopefully, it's not too sweet. It's not too botanically.
And this is a strong drink, actually. I mean, you notice anything frequently, a classic drink that's served up is going to be a bit strong.
So, and we're making this tonight.
And the glass is very chilled, which I just love.
It must be, yes.
And our adage is that a well-made cocktail is a battle which no ingredient wins.
Oh, my goodness.
I knew she'd be happy.
Yeah. Balance is everything. And a drink like this is a perfect example. First of all, it's only three ingredients, which is a perfect example of what we try and do in the book, which is simplify. You know, you don't want to come home after a long day, especially if you had to put the kids to bed and make dinner and all of these other things. You don't want 50 ingredients. If you want that in a drink, go out and pay the money and enjoy the show at a bar.
Yeah.
That's what those guys and girls
do. Now, what ingredient here did you make at home again? What
the
was
grenadine.
Grenadine.
What does that mean to make grenadine? What did you do?
It's a secret.
I can't tell you.
Exactly.
So it's very complicated, and it basically consists of going out and getting not pomegranate cocktail, but pomegranate juice, like the Palm brand, and mixing it with sugar.
That's it.
It is.
And we put a little orange flower water, rose flower water in there just to brighten it up a little bit. But yeah, really, that's all it is.
That is real. In all seriousness, I'm not saying it just to make you happy. You're kind enough to join us.
You could do that.
It is really
though,
a wonderful drink.
Thank you.
It's great.
We're talking to Leslie and David Salmonson, the authors of The 12 Bottle Bar, which is a great book. And I just checked the index. The Clipper Cocktail is in the index, so I can try that as well this weekend. But here's my question. I probably won't be making my homemade grenadine. Will I ruin it if I just get regular grenadine?
No, but what you need to do is... You've tasted the drink.
It's delicious.
When you use store-bought grenadine, always say is typically you want to add a little bit of sugar to it. So maybe half and half of sugar. Mm-hmm. Grenadine, we use a half a teaspoon, so it's a very small portion of sweetener to this drink. We don't find that most store-bought grenadines are sweet enough to do what they need to do. So,
and there's an artificiality to them a lot of times, especially that day glow color. So if you do make the drink, your drink is going to look like Kool-Aid.
Now let me ask you a question that's bothered me. You recommend no olives in the martini, the olives on the side of the martini. I really love the olives. I like that
when
they get
saturated. Well, you can still eat them on the side.
Well, they get saturated more with the liquor when they're in the drink. You know, why olives on the side? What's the thinking?
Here's the thing. I don't like them in my martini.
You do not.
But I'd like to eat an olive, take a sip.
Okay.
So as a host, if I present them on the side, you have your option.
I
have my option.
Okay.
That's right.
That's very
Absolutely.
Good.
Absolutely.
Why can so few people make martinis, bartenders?
As a culture, we lost our ability to make drinks after Prohibition. All the great bartenders either got out of the business or they went to go be soda jerks. Generality speaking here, but that was sort of the pervasive culture at the time. In the 50s, this little thing called vodka came along. Now, a martini is a balance between gin and vermouth. We like 5-1, 5 parts gin, 1 part vermouth. When vodka came along, you get rid of all those gin botanicals, replace it with vodka. You have a big glass of 5 parts that are supposed to taste relatively like nothing, and there is flavor in vodka, with vermouth, and it's out of balance. So what do? We start cutting back the vermouth because we think there's too much vermouth in our drink, and we end up with a glass of cold vodka. So we've forgotten how to make a martini. And I think not everybody, but you'll find a lot of martinis out there.
And there's nothing wrong if you want a martini. It depends on the bar you go to. But there's nothing wrong with asking your bartender to make it you want the way you want it.
Can I tell you something?
I regret that
you
were
the ultimate twofers. Great book and great drink.
It's really great to see you both.
Leslie
and David Salmonson, husband and wife team behind the book, and you should get it. It's really fun.
It is fun.
And full of great instructions and anecdotes. The 12-bottle bar. You can catch them tonight, 7 o'clock, the Brookline Booksmith.
Great
thank
bookstore.
You so much for
Look
coming
to meet
in.
You both.
And thank
Wonderful.
You all
thank
for
you
listening
so much.
To another edition of Boston Public Radio. We're going to 3 hours in September. Tune in tomorrow. We're going to have a 3-hour show tomorrow from 11 to 2. Our first hour will be exclusively online at WGBHnews.org. And to lure you over to the internet, we're having some of our best guests in that hour. Charlie Sennett, Art Kaplan, and Sue O'Connell. Our show's a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio.
And by the way, to get us through 3 hours, we'll have clippers ready for everyone
we'll
involved.
We'll have clippers, that's right.
I'm Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Thanks for listening, and please tune in for 3 hours tomorrow.